Going to talk about money, I'll just put up my wee sign and remind you that if you love the Vancouver Institute and would like to join in the thrill of these things and to get the advanced copy of the spring program, which will be another excellent one, you may join on the way out. And if we had 1,000 members, we would know that we should prepare for 1,000 people every week. Apart from that, nothing more on finance. Our speaker this evening, Robert Solomon, is a native of Pennsylvania, graduate of the University of Pennsylvania in molecular biology, and holds graduate degrees in philosophy and psychology from the University of Michigan. He is currently a member of the faculty at the University of Texas at Austin. He's held visiting appointments at a number of universities, both in the United States and in New Zealand, in Australia, and is currently visiting professor of philosophy here at UBC for the autumn semester. He's the author of several books on existentialism and other aspects of philosophy, and the author of many articles. In addition to his scholarship, he has been much in demand for public lectures over the last 10 years, and we're very happy to welcome him to the Vancouver Institute this evening. I would invite him to address us on his subject, Emotions and Human Nature, Dr. Robert Solomon. I don't know whether this thing works or not. I'm not strangling the man, we're just getting the audio visuals right.
How far is that thing down?
I don't know what that's going to do with anything.
Let's just clip it. Do I come through this way?
No.
I will hold it. Let me begin by putting myself in my place, or actually in your place. I was at a poetry reading in Vancouver last night, and I was standing towards the back of the room when a girl came up and started talking to her friend. It seemed she had gotten there an hour early, put her coat on one of the seats in order to save it for herself, gone back, had a beer, a cigarette, had come back up and found, as she was relating it to her friend, that a very rude man had taken her seat and wouldn't give it back. She was telling this as if it were just one of the sort of interesting but not very important events of the day, and I was struck by it. In Texas, there probably would have been a shooting. In New York, the lawyers would start coming out of the woodwork. In a sense, her behavior was incomprehensible to me. I could understand it only by analogy, thinking about what some other incident might be like to me that I wouldn't get angry, but others would. But what I've just introduced in a tourist's clumsy way is a question that troubles not just philosophers, but anthropologists, social science, scientists, and of course, tourists. You might give it a fancy name and call it emotional relativism. What it means is this. It's the exact opposite of a common sense, but I think false, popular idea. Namely, that all people, deep down, that is, emotionally, are basically the same. They might differ in their customs. They might differ in what gets them angry. They might differ in certain aspects of their other behavior, the way they think, what they read, whether they read. But at least in terms of emotions, or at least certain basic emotions, we're all just people. Well, notice the example I started with is not just a matter of local color. It's not drawn from New Guinea or imaginary Martians, as a great many philosophers are prone to do, but it's right next door. The question quite naturally arises, of course, and I'm sure you've all asked it yourself at one point or another, perhaps after a family fight, whether not just people from different cultures, but whether anyone really understands anyone else's feelings. Now, I could launch at this point into a quite long and very boring argument about what's called human nature, whether all people are ultimately the same or irreducibly different, whether everyone's selfish, as some recent libertarians are insisting, whether everyone's compassionate, as everyone who's a good liberal believes, whether everyone is envious or romantic or loving or aggressive, territorial, religious, fearful, or whatever. But I don't think those arguments go anywhere. And part of the reason is they're too abstract. Because what's really at stake, I think, is the nature of emotions, not so much human nature. And as I'll point out to you at the end of the lecture, I really don't believe in human nature anyway. But first, I want to talk about emotions, and that's what I'll really be talking about most of this evening. Consider the way we talk about anger, for example. I get all heated up. It builds up inside of me. I'm ready to explode. I blow up. I boil over. I let off some steam, or I bottle it up. Perhaps I let it all hang out, in line with some recent psychology. Even in courts of law, which think themselves above metaphor, the distinction that becomes crucial is between being hot and cold-blooded. I wondered why the young Canadian woman last night wasn't just ready to burst. Well, now, if we look at these metaphors, and I could add 100 more, a single image strikes you in every single one of them. We treat ourselves, as far as emotions are concerned, as some kind of hydraulic system, some kind of boiler. There's some kind of hot gas or dangerous liquid which is being heated up inside of us, ready to somehow escape or explode. It's a very curious image when you think about it. The idea, and of course it translates quite well into some very influential theories in psychology, is that there is this dangerous medium inside pressing against the poor, tenuous fabric of the ego, and we do everything we can to keep it in, pen it up, dam it up, and so on. Occasionally there are shifts in metaphor, for example, the more Newtonian image, flying off the handle, but I won't treat that in any detail. But the general picture, and one can expand this not just past anger to other emotions that are obviously related, but to virtually every emotion, is what I sometimes call the myth of the passions. It's, in fact, a myth of passivity. The idea is that emotions happen to us. The very word passion means a kind of suffering. You think, for example, of the Passion of Christ. We talk about being struck by jealousy, paralyzed by fear, haunted by guilt, driven by fury, and of course, all those butcher's images of love. Of course, we fall in love. Hearts are bruised and broken, hearts pounding, bursting, growing cold. They're sometimes stabbed, often smitten, and so on. The medieval medics took these same ancient metaphors, and they are ancient metaphors, and they built a theory around them. Emotions were based on the so-called humors of the body. I find the word itself humorous, but that's something else. Emotions are based on the fluids of the body. Too much of one will give you rage, too much of another will give you resentment, and so on. And talk about emotions often turned into talk which was very hydraulic just by virtue of this new quasi-medical jargon. In modern times, as I already mentioned very briefly, the same metaphor comes again in respectable, that is, scientific form. Sigmund Freud, I think most importantly and most notably, but also William James, took exactly the same kind of hydraulic metaphor and found a convenient, scientifically locatable medium for it. The boiler model is, to put it mildly, unflattering, but of course the newly discovered system of neurons in the body fit the old model quite well. And so Freud developed a theory, and I've argued elsewhere that actually dictates much of what he does for his entire career, in which the whole of the human psyche is to be thought of in terms of some mysterious quantity or fluid or energy which is flowing through the body, which gets pent up, which gets overwhelming, which sometimes escapes in the right way, sometimes escapes in the wrong way, which we go to therapists to learn how to sublimate, channel, and so on. In general, in other words, the picture is pretty much the same as it was for the ancients, except now we've got science to characterize it. Well, as a metaphor, I wouldn't want to criticize it just as a metaphor. But there are good metaphors and bad metaphors, helpful metaphors and terrible metaphors. The problem with this metaphor is, to begin with, it separates us right from the start from our emotions. Freud sums it up in a two-letter word borrowed from the Latin. The emotions are part of the it. They're something which we inherit from our animal past. They are something which are quite literally not us, not our ego. They are something that threaten us, something to be dealt with, and if not be gotten rid of, at least to be channeled in the best, that is, most constructive, least dangerous way. The general picture, then, of emotions, and Freud is just one of course, many people who have argued this explicitly, is that emotions turn out to be kinds of disruptions. Emotions interrupt what would otherwise be our calm, rational lives. Emotions are adolescent. When we put emotions into books and films, we often complain about their being sentimental or mawkish. When people are a little bit too emotional, they're self-indulgent. We talk about emotions as weaknesses, to be criticized in men, to be belittled in women. And of course, that difference is revealing. We admire the cold and the calculating. We like efficiency. If you look at the billboards for any Winston or Marlboro ad, I assume they're here the same as they are in the States, what do you have are these stone cruel faces. That's not what smoking does to you, I take it, but rather that's the kind of ideal. Somehow you're trying to be a real person. And by the way, it's now women who have these stone faces as well as the men. We have heroes like James Bond, Charles Bronson, and how do they make the reputation? Clint Eastwood, of course, by not cracking an emotional expression, ever. Well, all this strikes me as being terribly wrong. It certainly doesn't have anything to do with the way I or any of my friends live our lives. Our emotions, it seems, are not just the most memorable moments in our lives. When you ask me, well, what do you remember best in your life? I'm not going to remember so much the time that I solved a mathematical puzzle, unless, of course, it was very important to me to do so. I'm going to remember times when I fell in love, times when I was embarrassed, times when I was ashamed, times when I felt guilty, and so on. But it's not just moments, it's structures as a whole. And I'll come back to this point again and again. Too often, the view of emotions, as in Freud, as in the ancient metaphor, is that emotions somehow break through to the surface. Emotions break through the rational structure. That emotions are momentary disruptions, they're interruptions, rather than the structures of our life as such. Even a philosopher like Jean-Paul Sartre, whom I follow in a great many of my ideas, turns out in the end to treat emotions as some kind of escape, as some kind of pulling away from reality, as some kind of moving away from the things that we really do in life, which, embarrassingly enough for an existentialist, turn out to be a lot more rational than he would like to admit. The problem, though, is not just the fact that we and the philosophers for 2,000 years or more, one can go back to Socrates, have generally tended to put emotions in an inferior place. The concept we have of emotions, as emphasized in this model that I'm trying to point out, and of course I've picked the most dramatic and in some ways the silliest example, but if you think about it, the way we talk about love, the way we talk about anger, the way we talk about jealousy, often takes on, if in more sophisticated guise, exactly this kind of image of something that's happened to us, rather than, as I shall argue, something we've done. Well, the thesis that I want to argue tonight, at least the main thesis I want to argue, is really just that. That what we've done systematically through history is misunderstand our emotions. Now you might say, how could we have been so silly? And I think that deserves an answer right away. If you've ever had a friend who has said to you after insulting you horribly, well, I couldn't help it, I was just angry, as if to get off the hook. Or if you have a friend who is miserably embarrassing in public, and tries to explain it away by saying, well, I can't help it, I'm in love. You've probably had a glimmer of the thesis that I want to advance right now. And that is, our misunderstanding is an extremely convenient one. Our misunderstanding one allows us to look at emotions as excuses, the things that we do, which in fact are the most important to us, which sometimes are the things we've really wanted to do all our lives, are dismissed as if, oh, well, that was a momentary aberration. If you admit, well, gee, I mean, it took me getting angry to tell you what I've always thought of you, an awful lot of friendships would dissolve. Whereas this way you say, okay, you were just angry. Okay. Well, let me try and put it in more careful terms, in terms of, first, a theory which I'd like to reject, and secondly, at a bit more length, a theory that I'd like to try to get you to accept. The theory I'd like to reject could be summarized in a way that's so indisputable that you will probably begin to wonder why I could have anything to say against it. It can be summarized in the phrase, emotions are feelings. And you're all saying, well, of course they are. What else could they be? Well, in a way they're feelings. But consider the following. There's the feeling I have of cold water dripping down my back. There's the feeling I have that there's something wrong with this geometrical proof. There's the feeling I have that I got to get out of town fast. And then there's the feelings that we generally identify with emotions. Well, to say that something's a feeling, obviously, isn't to say anything all that informative about it, except that it's, in some way, some part of my experience. And of course, I'm not going to reject that. But the problem is that when people talk about emotions as feelings, what immediately leaps to mind, and not just lay people, but again, our best psychologists, and again, I'll mention William James, what immediately leaps to mind is the idea that, oh yes, it's a feeling, very much like the feeling you have, for example, when you've got the flu. So that when you ask, what is it to be in love? Someone who doesn't think about the question very long, or at least isn't in love at the moment and isn't going to describe it in the kind of quasi-religious tones that we're used to, will probably say something like, to be in love is to be flushed all over, it's to not be able to sit down, it's to lose your appetite, it's to feel a little weak in the knees, it's to perhaps have both your brain and your bowels a little bit looser than usual. And in general, one might say it's like the flu but without the virus. Well, if you think of emotions in that way, and a great many people do, then it's going to turn out that of course emotions are going to look like disruptions, interruptions, and so on. Of course emotions are going to seem like diseases of a sort. I mean, one could go all the way back to the ancients, find the Greeks and the Romans saying things like, being angry is a form of madness, being in love is a form of madness, the first one from Horace, the second from Plato. In short, the idea that emotions are something wrong, and in particular something physiologically wrong, which again brings us back to the kind of animalistic paradigm, that there's something that comes from our animal nature or whatever. Well, the problem at this point is that if you look at emotions as feelings of that sort, it turns out, first of all, that lots of times, as when you have the flu, you can have those feelings and not have the emotion at all. It also turns out that you can have an awful lot of emotions and not have feelings of that kind at all. Let me give you a somewhat silly, but I think rather telling example. Suppose you have one of these standard Sunday family style columns in your local paper, and there's an interview, as there usually is, with one of the local couples who has just celebrated their 50-year anniversary. In the interview, it's asked, have you really been in love all that time? Now, let's make it a fairly philosophical interviewer with a bone to pick. And they're arguing, as a matter of fact, for just this theory, which I have characterized as, let's call it the feeling theory, and asking, have you really loved each other all that time? And the couple give a polite smile and say, yes, we have. And one can imagine the interviewer at this point saying, well, I want to ask you something. I mean, how did you live so long? I mean, for 70 years or 50 years, you've not slept very well, you had no appetite, you've had loose bowels, I mean, and so on. At which point the couple will probably be fairly perplexed. Look at the interviewer in confusion and say, no, believe me, we haven't had any problems like that. And the interviewer will say, as a philosopher would, well, maybe it's not necessary that you felt that all along, but at least you must admit you've had a disposition, philosophers would say, to have it. In other words, under certain circumstances, you would feel that about each other. To which the couple, now confused but a little annoyed, will say, no, as a matter of fact, we've never felt any of that. And the interviewer, now frustrated, says, well, certainly when you first met, right, when you fell in love, you felt something like that. At which point the couple look at the interviewer fairly disgusted, ready to walk out, and say, "No, as a matter of fact, we were 3 and 4 years old respectively when we met when we were in Sunday school. We've sort of grown up together. We've never had any of those, you know, singles, bars, encounters. We have simply grown up, got married, we've lived this life together, and we have loved each other the whole way along." Now, what's the interviewer to say? Well, if the interviewer has any philosophical wisdom, they'll probably give up the feeling theory or at least amend it seriously. The problem here, though, goes deeper than just one silly example, which doesn't tell you much about anything. The problem, among other things, is what philosophers would call the choice of a paradigm. It goes back again to the ancients, and it's in the medievals. It's in William James quite explicitly, and it's often in Freud. What I mean is this. Whenever you ask anyone for an example of an emotion, what they will give you is some emergency, some case in which you're off balance, or what one philosopher has called a case of agitation. William James, whom I've mentioned quite a few times, let me actually use him explicitly, gives as his central example of an emotion, walking through the woods, and out from behind the tree steps a bear. "I feel fear." Now, as a philosopher or as a psychologist, and he was both, how do we analyze that? James's analysis, and he's perhaps the best example of what I'm calling the feeling view, is this. I see the bear. My perception of the bear causes in me certain kinds of, he calls them, visceral changes, right? Including a tightening of my stomach and all the other things I've listed. I then have an experience of that visceral change. In other words, I feel my stomach tighten, I feel my knees loosen, I feel myself getting flushed and so on. That's the emotion. Now, the problem with the paradigm is that it leaves out of even passing consideration this other kind of example, the couple that love each other for 50 years. If you take the Jamesian urgency case seriously, you're going to be pushed to the conclusion that this couple doesn't really love each other. Or maybe they did once, but they've forgotten about it. And it seems to me that's an intolerable conclusion. If two people say, and I have every reason to believe them, that they love each other for 50 years, but they say they've never, you know, been nauseous and so on, I don't see any reason to reject them. On the contrary, my problem is, why is it so continuously the case that philosophers take these emergency cases and make them out to be the best example? Well, let me offer one possible way around this and say this. Isn't it possible that when we have an emergency case, the bear steps out from behind the tree, that what we're characterizing wrongly, I think, as essential to the emotion is in fact simply essential to the emergency case? Maybe emotions are something very different from what James and all these other people have been talking about. That emotions are things which can very easily last a lifetime. And what might not be the case, in some instances, is that what we call emotions in this kind of emergency situation are even emotions at all. Well, the feeling view in general has lots of problems. The paradigm situation that I've talked about just now is only one of them. One might say, well, sure, but you have to adjust the paradigms, and maybe there's a more subtle feeling. For example, the philosopher David Hume, who many of you who have had a philosophy course have probably read at some point, would say, look, there are violent passions and there are calm passions, and what you're talking about with the couple that love each other for 50 years is a calm passion. It can last for a long time. It's like compassion. It's like the love of humanity. It's like a general sense of justice. It doesn't burn in you at any particular time necessarily, but it's rather, you might say, a slow burn or maybe a lukewarm fizz that lasts through your entire life. But this won't do either. I've already mentioned the argument, and this has been substantiated by a great many psychologists in an empirical way, as well as philosophers in an a priori way, and I should add that philosophers are much cheaper in this. But what it's been shown to be the case is that, look, you can have all these feelings, no matter how many you try to identify them, without having any particular emotion. And you can have any emotion at all, even including something akin to rage, without any particular feelings. For example, if you've just taken 20 milligrams of Valium before you decide to get men. In addition to this, there's a problem that's been pointed out again by both philosophers and psychologists, that suppose it were the case that every emotion is always accompanied by, and notice my shift from is to accompanied by, every emotion is always accompanied by these visceral sensations and so on. Well, let me ask you then, how you would know what emotion you're feeling? I mean, how would you know whether, let's say, all of a sudden, a woman or a man walks in the room, you have to take your own preference, a woman or a man walks in the room and all of a sudden you start fizzing, right? You start getting all hot and bothered, and how do you know whether you're angry at her or in love with her, or angry at him or in love with him, or maybe hate or envy, resentment, fear, any of those things? How can you tell from the feelings? Well, again, after lots of different kinds of demonstrations and experiments and so on, it becomes quite clear that the feelings, as we're referring to them now, are pretty much the same in every case. So we need something else. And the question is, given the traditional theory, what's the something else? A couple other small points, which I just want to mention. Obviously, this could be gone into in great detail, but not here. We sometimes talk in everyday language about an emotion being reasonable or unreasonable, justified or unjustified, foolish, wise, intuitive, insightful, and so on. This is not the way we generally talk about feelings simpliciter. We don't talk, for example, about a headache being clever or unreasonable or unwarranted. We don't talk about a foolish bout of nausea. But we do talk about a person being angry unjustifiably. We talk about a person falling in love stupidly. And the question then is, how can we do that? We don't talk about feelings that way. Again, something else has entered the picture. One other point. Emotions change with our various bits of understanding, with what we believe. Freud, for example, made his whole career with what he calls the talking cure. And what does that amount to? It amounts, among other things, to subtly, slowly, sometimes dramatically, changing a person's insights and beliefs about himself, about the world, and so on, in such a way as to change, at one point he thought actually diffuse, one's emotions. How is that possible? You have all kinds of different therapies. I suppose one of the latest and more successful is something that calls itself rational emotive therapy. It believes quite explicitly. If you change a person's beliefs, you'll change their emotions. How's that possible? Now you might say, well, isn't it curious that every time you change somebody's beliefs, you change their emotions too? But that's hardly a theory. And it seems to me if we can do something better, which I think we can, we ought to. Well, the negative theory then is what I'm calling the feeling theory. I've given it fairly short shrift, or a short talk anyway. One could say much more about it, but I think for most philosophers and psychologists, in one way or another, it's all but dead. The question is, what's to take its place? Well, one example, which I won't go into in any detail, is 100 different varieties of behavior theories. According to any of these theories, and as I say, there are many of them, an emotion is some pattern of behavior, some system of response. And of course, there's something very right about this. But at the same time, everyone, except for certain methodological fanatics, agrees that it seems to leave something out. Whether it's something scientific or not, whether it's something measurable or not, is not a question I'm concerned with. But there is an inside view of emotions. There's something that we go through, something like an emotional experience. And even if it's true that emotions typically, even necessarily, give rise to systems of behavior, we want to know, what's that inside thing? If it's not just a feeling, again, what could it be? Well, I'd like to provide, in as short a time as I can, and I will get out my time, an alternative theory that I've been working on for about 10 years now. For those of you who are curious, and people always sort of imagine this, so I figure it's better to tell them straight off, I'll tell you how I got into it. I was going through the tail end and the losing end of one of those tragic love affairs that we all have and so on, and I really didn't know what to do with myself. I was going through the usual turmoil saying things, "I will never do this again, how could I have been so stupid?" And you all know the lines, you've said them yourself. But what occurred to me as a philosopher, and one big advantage of a philosopher is you can turn any problem into a puzzle. But one of the things that started to bother me was, among other things, the fact that I also valued this relationship, as disastrous as it was, so much. Was that just stupid? Or was I now being stupid? Well, I started to decide that I was now being stupid. That there was something wrong with my view of emotions, and that's what started giving rise to the whole theory. I mean, if I really thought that this very important affair in my life was nothing but a matter of physiological distress followed by another kind of physiological distress, I hadn't moved too far in my some, I won't tell you how many years. But it turns out, according to a theory, and whether the theory rationalizes the experience or just comes from it, I will leave up to you. But it comes down to the insight, which I've tried to anticipate so far, that emotions are really much more than what we give them credit for. That, as a matter of fact, it's not the case, as Freud, who sometimes was a romantic, but I think more likely could be called a good rationalist, it's not the case that our lives really could be or ought to be or would hopefully be this kind of unbroken spectrum of rational behavior. That what's important to us really is emotions, and if we don't have them from outside circumstances, I mean, if there's a war or somebody's throwing bottles at you, then you create them. And we all have friends who are bored, so they make themselves indignant about something. They make themselves fall in love with someone. And that's the kind of other side that I wanted to understand. Why do we do that? How do we do it? Well, I've already indicated only briefly, but this is the key to the whole theory, that there's a sense in which we do our emotions. Now, it's curious that we can't say that grammatically in English, because I think we ought to be able to, but that doesn't stop me. The fact is that emotions really aren't a species of feeling, are not merely a pattern of behavior, and certainly are nothing, as some people say when they try to express an emotion which is important to them, ineffable, indescribable, and all the other trash that is sometimes said about emotions like love. Love is perfectly describable. Love is perfectly manageable. Sometimes it's impossible. That's a different question. But love and all emotions is a structure. And what I'd like to do now is try and describe what that structure consists of and what it does. The way of summarizing the theory, and I guess it's probably best to do that first and then work my way out of the obvious problems in the summary, is to say that emotions are systems of judgments. Now, that sounds very intellectual, and I intend it to, because one of the things I want to insist upon, and with this you can start to anticipate how I will get back to my starting thesis, one of the things I want to insist upon is that emotions are learned, that emotions take sophistication, that emotions require finesse, that emotions consist of a very sophisticated set of concepts, not least of which is the concept of oneself. So it's not as if emotions are simply animal or primitive. As a matter of fact, if you want a good distinction between animals and humanity, not a distinction I'm very worried about, but if you want one, I'd say forget about reason and the fact that, as Bertrand Russell put it sarcastically, we, unlike the animals, are capable of doing sums, but rather think in terms of what animals have anything even remotely akin to romantic love or moral indignation. And I know my cat sometimes looks like that after a bath, but I don't believe it. Okay. Well, there's this idea that emotions are conceptual. They're sophisticated. They're learned. They are, in an important sense, intellectual, which doesn't mean that you have to think out your emotions in any deliberate sense. Of course not. Although, sometimes you do. Sometimes you make yourself angry, and if you watch yourself, you can even see yourself do it. Something trivial happens to you, and you say, "That was annoying." And then you think for a minute and say, "No, that wasn't annoying, that was offensive." And then you think some more and you say, "That wasn't just offensive, that was really an affront to my dignity." And you keep on going. And if you work at it after an hour, you can be in a livid state. Right? And then you will probably go to a friend and say, "Guess what just happened to me, and I'm so mad." But of course, you did it yourself. And that's the negative side. Of course, we fall in love much the same way. You see someone and say, and I'll take the male view, but forgive me, I just happen to be that way. You meet someone, you say, gee, she's pretty, and you forget about it. And someone says to you in a minute, you know, hey, so that girl you're talking to, she was pretty. And I think, yeah, she was pretty. She was really pretty. And okay, there I go. Right? Very simple. Well, this is to say that emotions can sometimes be deliberate and actually thought out. And I think we do that a lot more than we're willing to admit. But of course, it doesn't have to be. A lot of judgments that we make aren't deliberate or what philosophers would call reflective at all. I mean, for example, most of you are making all kinds of judgments even as you sit there, right? That the seat will not collapse out from under you, that the seat will support your weight, that when you finally put your feet back on the floor to walk out of the building, it will be there, and so on. All the things that only philosophers, and in particular some British epistemologists, worry about, right? Those are all judgments, but until I mention them, I can be sure that none of you are actually thinking about them. Fair enough. Well, that's what I want to say emotions consist of. Those sorts of non-reflective, some people would say spontaneous, judgments about yourself and judgments about the world and the relationship between the two. Now, it's important to add at this point that if I'm going to talk about judgments, notice that the advantage of this category is that it makes perfectly good sense to talk about making judgments. And in just the same way, I would want to say we make our emotions. Now, we don't always do it from scratch. I mean, I can't just sort of stand here and say, okay, I will now be angry, and then that would be a bit strange. But of course, there are lots of other things we can't just decide to do either, right? You can't just decide to ride a bicycle if you've never done it before, decide to fly a jet plane, and so on. You can't just decide to speak French. You have to learn. You have to learn emotions too. It happens that we're taught our emotions by our culture, and here I'm sort of wheedling back to the main thesis. We're taught our emotions by our culture from a very early age. And as a matter of fact, all those stereotypes that we all have learned to hate, that Canadians are this way, and Americans are this way, and New Yorkers are this way, that's different from Americans, the French are this way, and the Germans are this way, and the Russians are this way, in fact, there's something very right about all that, even if our good sort of humanitarian conscience often won't let us say it. We are, in fact, taught different emotions, but let me come back to that later. Another advantage of talking about judgments here, in addition to the fact that they're something that we make, is that we very reasonably hold people responsible for the judgments that they make. Someone might have been raised in the backwoods of Alabama. They may have been taught racial prejudice from the time they were old enough to see and to talk. But still, if they live in Vancouver and they're over the age of 5, we're still going to hold them responsible and say, you've got to change that way of thinking, that's not the right way to think, and so on. We don't let a person say, well, that's just the way I think, right? I mean, that's not acceptable. So judgments are things for which we're held responsible. And so I want to argue we're responsible for emotions. Now, you might say, this is pretty odd. I mean, what do you mean emotions are judgments? Well, let me spell it out. Eventually, with a long example, but first by sort of distinguishing two kinds of judgments, which I hope will start making things clear as a total picture. First, notice that lots of judgments, and these will not be the ones that I'm interested in, are mere judgments of fact. I judge right now, and philosophers love to talk this way, I judge that there's a pitcher on this table. All right, I hope you all agree with that. If you don't, it doesn't matter. I'm judging a matter of fact. There's another kind of judgment. Some people, all my freshmen, for example, insist on calling them value judgments. And that's not so bad, but I'd rather talk about a different category here. And that's judgments which aren't true by virtue of a fact, but rather something that becomes true by virtue of the judgment. Now, in the philosophy of language, a British philosopher about 20 years ago developed a very complicated theory, which is still being worked out by some of his disciples, which he called speech act theory. I'm not going to bore you with the details for this lecture, but it made the same important distinction with reference to language. What he said was, there are certain kinds of statements that describe things that are true. Okay, let's forget about those. But there are other statements that if you think of them as describing something as true, you're never going to understand what they say. If I say, I promise you to pay you the $5 I owe you, I'm not simply stating it's true that there's a promise. There isn't a promise. In saying, I promise, I am making the promise. And so on. If I christen a baby, say, I hereby name you Alfonso, and so on, I am making that the baby's name. Or let's make it my dog's name, or whatever. Okay. In general, there's some things that I make true by saying something. Well, there are also things that I make, maybe you don't want to use the word true, I'm not worried about that, by judging something. Well, this is the kind of thing that I'm talking about when I talk about emotions as judgments. And in particular, what I'm worried about are different judgments of what you might call importance, different judgments of perspective, and the like. Now, the visual term here, and I find myself using a lot of visual metaphors for all this, is something like, I suppose, the kind of perspective, not that you learn when you read about the Italian Renaissance and how things small as they get in the distance, that's not very important. But rather, if you think of perspective as the ancient Chinese or the Egyptians practiced it, right? I mean, the king is five times as big as anyone else. Well, think of the experience you have if you're in love with someone and you walk in a room, let's even say they're the only one there you know, and there's a sense in which, and I don't think I'm being just kind of poetic, there's a sense, it's not good poetry anyway, there's a sense in which they are literally bigger than everyone else. They might be the only one you see in the entire room. If you have to mail a letter and it's got to go out by the 5 o'clock mail and it's now 4:49, right, you're going to drive frantically through the city as much as that's possible in Vancouver. You're going to drive frantically through the city looking for a mailbox, and the only thing you're going to see in your experience, except for a few red lights, is going to be mailboxes or the lack thereof. In other words, what emotions do is emotions are systems of judgments, and I will go into that in a little bit of detail in a minute, systems of judgments which cast the world in a certain kind of way. They give importance to some things, they take away importance from other things. If you're talking about something like love, then it's fairly clear that what you do when you, quote, fall in love, but I think love is much more like a commitment or a decision than a falling, but what you do when you fall in love is you make someone particularly important to you, to your identity, to your self-esteem. It matters what they say, think, and so on. When you get angry, what you do is you make someone into a guilty party, and I'll talk about that in a second, and so on for other emotions like envy and resentment and jealousy and the like. Well, I promised you a long example. Let me get to it. The example I want to use is anger. Anger is a convenient one because, unlike fear, it's got an interesting, complex structure. One of the reasons why I think so many people who want to demean or diminish emotions start out with fear is kind of a minimal emotion. I mean, if there's anything that deserves kind of an animal-level description, it's at least some forms of fear, certainly looking at a bear standing right in front of you. Love, on the other hand, which I agree is the most interesting emotion, but love has too much other stuff, too much baggage that you have to get rid of before you start talking about it at all. I mean, you have to get rid of platonic love, you have to get rid of love of God, you have to get rid of all sorts of things before you can understand so simple as what it is to love another person. So let's not worry about love, except maybe at the end. But anger is nice and neat. People don't have strong opinions about anger anymore. They once did. It's one of the seven deadly sins. But most people would say now, as a matter of fact, now it's becoming a matter of popular cant, that it's good to get angry once in a while. If you never get angry, there's probably something wrong with you, and so on. At the same time, no one would say that anger is simply good in itself. No one would say, for example, if you don't get angry all the time, you're a lousy person, as some people do say about love, you know, have to love everybody, and so on. But anger, then, I think, sort of is a neutral example, and also, as I hope you'll see, it's sort of ideal for what I want to do with it. Well, let me sort of apply the theory I'm briefly trying to work out with you to this particular emotion. First, I would want to say that anger consists not of a feeling. As a matter of fact, lots of times I'm angry and I don't feel anything at all. Especially, for example, if I am angry at, let's say, my dean for a period of 5 years. It's very unlikely that even at any point during that time, I'm going to have any unusual physiological symptoms. I might not, doesn't matter. I'm still angry all the time. You might say, when you're asleep, yeah, while I'm asleep. I dream about my dean. Anyway. Anger is not a feeling, Of course it's tied to behavior, but what the behavior analysis always leaves out, and now I'll bring it back since I didn't talk about it before, is any reason why certain behaviors go with certain emotions. I mean, it's always left in a kind of empty definitional form. When a person is angry, then they will do such and such and such and such. Well, even if that turned out to be true, which it's usually not, even if it turned out to be true, the question is, why should there be any connection? I mean, why, when you're angry at someone, don't you kiss them? I mean, sometimes you do, but it's a very special circumstance. Why, when you're in love with someone, don't you slap them around? Well, some people do, but it's not the typical expression. Well, philosophers and psychologists typically leave this open to question. Well, it's just that's what you do when you love someone, or that's what you do when you're angry. But what we have to do is somehow tie all that together. Well, suppose we say that anger consists of a system of judgments. What judgments? Well, to begin with, I already mentioned one. Anger has to do with making someone into a guilty party. Anger is a judgment of being offended. You can make it a logical point in the following way. You could say, one simply cannot be angry unless he or she believes that someone else, namely the person you're angry at, has wronged one, offended one. If you believe the other person has offended you, that in itself won't make you angry, right? For example, if you say something to me in German, and I wasn't really listening, I have to listen in order to understand German. I wasn't really listening, and my friend says, hey, he just insulted you in German. And I would say, oh, I have come to believe that this person has insulted me, but of course I'm not offended. So I don't feel angry. The extra ingredient here is I have to take it personally. And that's where all the other judgments come in. And the way I summarize this, in a too short phrase, is to say that what makes all emotions emotions, or what makes a system of judgments an emotion, is the fact that it includes a whole series of judgments about my self-esteem. If you aren't self-involved, it's not emotional. And that goes not just for love, it goes for anger, it goes for worship, faith, any emotion you can think of. Now, there's some problems here that I'm sure some of you will bring up in the discussion. But the general point I want to make is this. The idea of selfless love, for example, the idea of worship in which one sees oneself as nothing, still includes a vision of oneself as nothing. In each case, it's a picture of oneself, and it's this judgment about oneself, or system of judgments about oneself, that makes the general system of judgments what we would call emotional. Now, you might get very excited about it, right? You might get all nervous, and of course, then your stomach starts going, your heart starts pounding, the adrenaline starts going, and all that. But sometimes yes, sometimes no. Even if always yes, my argument would be that's not the emotion. And by focusing on those more visceral features of emotion, so many philosophers and psychologists, even the best, have missed what the emotion's really about. But we don't have the time for that. When you think of someone who's angry, it's interesting that you also think of a certain kind of posture. I mean, you might think of someone who's red in the face, but it's not just that. For example, one of the things that you think about with anger is a kind of aggressive stance. There's a kind of tightening of the fists, often a kind of leaning forward. It's an interesting contrast, for example, with moral indignation, which is a very closely related emotion. Moral indignation, you're more likely to huff up and move back. In anger, you're more likely to lean across the desk and look and scowl at the other person. You're more likely to kind of tense up your jaw, perhaps even gnash your teeth. Charles Darwin, as a matter of fact, had a very interesting theory about that. He said the reason why we gnash our teeth when we get angry is because it's a vestigial remnant of a primal urge to bite the other person. It's not a bad theory. But if you think of the general posture of someone who gets angry, what I think you'll conclude very quickly is it's a hostile posture, and so on. And it's interesting that it varies from culture to culture. Again, another block against human nature. But in our culture, and I'm using that sort of generously, in our culture, anger is typified by kind of shaking a fist, gnashing the jaw, kind of narrowing your eyes in a kind of condemnatory squint, and so on. And if you ask, what does that posture represent? My answer is the following. But it's just the beginning of the following, really. I'm playing a role. What kind of role? Well, let me move on a bit. What kind of things do you think about? Or what kind of things do you say when you get angry? Well, if anger were just a feeling, I guess the question is, why don't you just sort of say, oh, I feel so uncomfortable. That would be a reasonable thing to say if that's all that were going on. But that's not what you say at all. What you start doing is accusing the other person of all kinds of things. Not just the offense at hand, but you'll say things like, you always do this to me. Or you'll say things perhaps even like, everyone always does this to me. In short, what you're going to do is sound very much like a court prosecutor. You're going to start making a case. You're going to start thinking about all the things wrong this person has done to you before, all the similar wrongs that have happened in the universe, how you are sort of here defending human dignity and so on. There's a very kind of proud, self-righteous, condemnatory stance that's involved in getting angry. Well, now I think you can see how I'm going to start tying this picture together. Because what I want to say is that what happens when you get angry is you make a system of judgments, and obviously I've just mentioned a few, but you make a system of judgments which cast what I now sometimes call a scenario. I used to call it a mythology in my book. I decided that just is loaded with too many other connotations. But you cast a scenario, a kind of stage setting, a dramatic setting in which you play a part. So when I said before, what you do is give a kind of perspective to your surroundings. You interpret. You try and give a meaning to yourself, your place in the world, other people, and so on. Now I can spell that out with a little bit of detail. What you do is you cast a kind of dramatic setting. The other person plays a part too, namely the guilty one. There might be other people in it too who are, let's say, the courtroom spectators. Every case of anger, I want to say, is something like a courtroom scenario. You cast yourself as judge, magistrate, as prosecutor, as the one that lays out the sentence, the one that provides the evidence, and perhaps even, if you're bigger than the other guy, executioner too. It is, of course, a kangaroo court. No one ever gets a fair trial in it. The judge pretty much has the law books loaded in this case. But it's, nevertheless, not just something you feel, to use the usual word, inside, but it's a kind of projection you throw over the world as a whole. Now, of course, other people may or may not agree with that particular projection, and there's a whole dialogue, of course, that would have to go on about what happens when other people reject your projection. What happens when you fall in love with someone, which means making them very important to you, and they say they never want to see you again? Well, there's a problem. Or what happens when you get very angry with someone and they say to you, well, I just refuse to be angry. I'm not guilty. I haven't done anything, and I'm not angry at you either. It's a big problem there. So you'll probably do something to make them do something to you. Or, in the more complicated cases, you can have emotions which only are involved with people at a vast distance. Resentments like that. So is envy. Faith, perhaps, too. What's nice about these emotions is that they don't really involve the act of complicity of the other person, which is a way of saying that maybe envy and resentment and other emotions like them have a good chance of lasting much longer than the ones that are close up. You might say that's true of love at a distance too, but I'm a little hesitant to push that thesis. I was a little upset to find, after I'd been working on this for a couple of years, that the whole theory had sort of been pulled out from under me over 100 years ago. I don't know if any of you know this, but you've all read Alice in Wonderland. Well, there's one section in Alice in Wonderland, which I know for probably quite a few years I didn't read, despite the fact that my eyes were better than they are now. That is, it's a section called The Mouse's Tail. It sort of wiggles down the page in typical Carolian way. Right? Well, if your eyes are good enough or you've got a good magnifying glass and you look at the tip of the tail, you'll find the following little verse. I'll be judge, I'll be jury, said cunning old fury. Gee, that's the theory. I was a little embarrassed, but Lewis Carroll I'd rather have on my side. Anyway, what the theory comes down to then, with this particular case, is that anger is something that you actually do. It's a casting of a set of judgments which view the world in a certain way, and then, of course, you act out that role within the world as you have cast it. So why do you do the things you do when you're angry? Well, suppose I put it in terms of the following very simple question. why are people who are angry typically aggressive and hostile? Well, not because we define anger that way, but rather because, if you think of it in this kind of courtroom way, if you're the indicting attorney, if you are the judge, the sentencer, and perhaps the executioner, well, of course there's going to be a kind of vindictive element to anger. If, on the other hand, what you're talking about is love, well, of course love is going to involve any behavior which, in fact, tends to emphasize the importance of the other person, keep them in your sphere, and so on, which most of the time turns out to be tenderness and encouragement, but not always. If it's resentment, of course, what you do is cast daggers from a distance. People who are resentful don't have very interesting behavior, but they generally tend to talk a lot. People who are envious, right? Again, there's the distance phenomenon, but there's going to be an obvious kind of reaction whenever certain kinds of events come into play. An interesting kind of difference, for example, with jealousy, which is one of those close-up emotions. I mean, you can't be jealous at a person who's too far away. I mean, you've got to be able to fight with them, or as in anger, it's no longer quite the same emotion. Well, I'd want to do the same kind of thing, in fact, for every emotion. I hint at it in the book, I'm working on others now, but what it amounts to is trying to understand all these different scenarios and how they're structured for each emotion. But there's another point here that I think, to show you, rare for a philosopher perhaps, the immediate practical importance of this kind of theory. And I've already hinted at it again in the beginning when I talked about, well, look, people make excuses and get themselves off the hook by saying, well, I was angry, I couldn't help it, and so on. But suppose, using this theory that I've just tried to briefly describe, you ask a question that you all probably asked in one form or another about yourselves or one of your friends or an ex-friend or whatever. Why is it that some people seem to get angry so much? Why is it that I, perhaps, seem to enjoy getting angry? Well, again, if anger is a kind of feeling, among other things, of, you know, tightening the stomach and all that, it seems like a pretty incomprehensible question. I mean, why would anybody enjoy that unless they're a straight-out masochist? But if anger, on the other hand, is putting yourself on the judge's bench and looking down at other people, if anger is a guaranteed form of self-righteousness, which you dictate for yourself, then all of a sudden you're going to have a very different view of people who have what's commonly called a bad temper. It's a very convenient way of threatening other people, of putting yourself in a superior position, of making yourself feel really good about yourself, even if there's no, what, a word I don't particularly like but always have to use, objective reason for doing so. Well, of course, it's the same with other emotions too. What's resentment about? Resentment, among other things, is an emotion which starts out with you in a kind of inferior position, right? I mean, Nietzsche, for example, the German philosopher, talked a great deal about the emotion of resentment. He talked about the resentment of slaves for their masters. Well, the way it works, how do we understand it? Well, you can't change your objective position. I mean, you can't change your position in the world. You're still a slave. They've got all the swords, right? But what you can do is change your view of the world. So what you start doing is you're taking all your own characteristics as a slave, and you characterize them as virtues. And you take all the characteristics of the master, strength, intelligence, power, wealth, their vices. And all of a sudden, without changing anything in the world, you've made yourself feel superior. Well, that's the way emotions in general work. And what you get out of it, again, now going back to a theme that I mentioned earlier, but just in passing, is in every case self-esteem. So I want to add a question to the usual repertoire of questions about emotions, right? The question is always, what's the payoff? What do you get out of it? Why are you getting angry? And the answer in general will be, because it makes you feel good, makes you feel superior, but that's not enough. You've got to push it and say, superior, what, why now, and so on. When people feel resentful, same kind of question. I mean, one of the things that I've sort of been arguing a lot lately, and did a piece in a national publication in the States a couple weeks ago that sort of brought it to light. But I've gotten very annoyed recently with the sort of resurfacing of the phenomenon of resentment in a great deal of social criticism all over the world right now. And I guess my reaction to it, without talking about it in any detail here, is simply this. Why? I mean, what's all this bitching and kvetching about? I mean, what's it getting you? Not just changing the world, because as a matter of fact, the changes they usually require are so radical that they're impossible. But what's the person that's making the complaint, getting out of that? And again, I think the answer, once the question is asked, is fairly obvious. Well, let me now wiggle back to my original statement, my original position, my original questions, and talk for just a minute about what I call emotional relativism. You can see how it follows, of course, from what I've said, if I'm right, that if emotions are judgments, systems of judgments, acts that we perform, scenarios that we perform in, and so on, then they are clearly learned by a culture. Now, it might be there are certain things which are common to infants of not just every human family, but perhaps most higher animals as well, maybe even angels, I don't know. For example, a certain kind of irritation, right? You're uncomfortable, you cry, or something like that. That's not interesting, that's not an emotion. Or there might be a certain sense of dependency, right? You're afraid your mother's going to drop you. Well, that's not interesting. I'm hesitant to call it an emotion. If you want to say it's a primitive emotion, I won't stop you. But of course, if you leap, as so many people do, from that very primitive fear to something like romantic love or Kierkegaard's cosmic dread, I think you're in trouble. Because what comes in between is an enormous learning experience. You couldn't have a Kierkegaard in India in a certain period. You couldn't have an Indian philosopher in Germany in a certain period. And forgetting about philosophers, since they're sort of special cases, what you find is, in general, that emotions are simply not the same all over the world, nor is there any reason why we should think they would be. I'll give you a couple examples. One that I've talked about quite a bit with some students here is an example that's actually come out by the research of a Canadian anthropologist named Jean Briggs, who's out in the other end of the world, in Newfoundland. She's worked with Eskimos in the Northwest Yukon Territories and so on, and she's come up with the following conclusion. These are people that don't get angry. Now, anger would seem to be a basic emotion of anything is, but they don't. And you might say, well, surely they get angry, they're just repressing it. That's sort of our post-Freudian self-righteousness. Well, they're not repressing anything. They don't get angry. Now, they get irritated, and you might say, I'm just mincing words. But if anything I've said tonight is correct, it's at least this, that mere irritation isn't enough to be worthy the word anger, much less something like moral indignation. That what's involved to turn that irritation into anger is a whole conceptual judgmental structure. Well, what would that be? Well, with Eskimos, and I get this from other people's research, I don't like the cold myself, but what that turns out to be for Eskimos is just this. Eskimos, unlike ourselves, and actually I should now qualify that quite a bit because it's certainly much more true of someone from New York or Pennsylvania than it would be of someone from Canada, but it's even less true of someone who's an Eskimo, and one could get a whole spectrum going here, that the concept of blame and responsibility plays a very different role in different cultures. Eskimo cultures, this particular Eskimo culture, I don't want to generalize, this particular Eskimo culture has the characteristic that it doesn't blame. If someone comes in and steals your wife or your dog or your sled or your house or your furniture, you don't complain. You might be irritated, but you don't blame. That's just the way things are. Sort of a Kurt Vonnegut line comes to mind here. It's a very short line. So it goes. I mean, that's kind of the Eskimo philosophy. Right? You get lost in the snow. Well, you sit down and die, right? You know what all of us would do. We'd scream and yell, and we'd finally fall down exhausted, and we'd still be trying to raise some cry of help. Not an Eskimo. Now, whatever you think of this, and I know my students are always trying to say, well, surely they ought to feel that, and so, but that's not the way it is. They have a different philosophy. They have a different conceptual outlook, and so they have different emotions. And in particular, here's a case where they lack one that we consider absolutely basic. I'll give you one other example. And this is the one you're all probably waiting for anyway. In the 18th century, and again in the 20th century, first the French and then the Germans made a miraculous discovery about free sex in Tahiti, right? Well, of course, there was a whole lot of very fascinating stuff that was going on, mainly watching the reactions of all these horny philosophers in France and Germany. But ultimately, what it came down to was the discovery that, whatever else you wanted to say about it, There wasn't any such thing as romantic love, despite what we would call a proliferation of hot sex in these islands. Well, romantic love, which some people who have never been beyond their own state or province would like to think is the universal characteristic of mankind, turns out to be, first of all, a distinctively Western, and as a matter of fact, very narrow Western invention, and what's more, a fairly recent invention. Didn't really come on the scene until the 12th century, which is one reason why I always wonder why philosophers always begin talking about love by reading Plato. I mean, Plato doesn't have any conception of love that, as far as I can see, has anything to do with ours. I mean, he was worried about appreciation of beauty. I mean, well, maybe, but hardly. If you look at the history of romantic love, even in our own, now broadly speaking, Western European society and so on, what you find is that it doesn't come into existence until something like the 12th century. And what's more, there are arguments on the field right now that are just beginning, at least I would want to advance them, that it came in not just because all of a sudden people invented an emotion or all of a sudden a faculty which had been hitherto untapped exploded, as the hydraulic metaphor would have it, but rather because of a socioeconomic change. People started becoming more economically independent. Feudalism was breaking down. People had a variety of roles, and so there was a distinction, perhaps for the first time, and here again, an important distinction in Plato, between family and social roles on the one hand, and the notion of self-identity on the other. You can't have romantic love if you don't have problems with self-identity. And of course, people spelled out this out in all sorts of clumsy and usually half-assed ways. They say, for example, you can't have love without self-love. There's a point to that, but of course, as a thesis, it won't stand. People say, love is self-sacrifice. Well, of course, you've got to have a self before you can sacrifice a self. Again, as a thesis, it won't stand, but there's an important insight there. Namely, romantic love is possible only in an individualistic society. What's more, it's possible only in a society where traditional family, social ties, and so on, have begun to break down. It's very important that our paradigm of romantic love is love between strangers, or love between people who shouldn't fall in love, I mean the prince and the charwoman, or perhaps the countess and her chauffeur. It's very important that it's a kind of surprise, and this is why we talk about falling in love. But it's not falling at all. And now let me go back to the point I made with the urgency paradigm and pretty much end with this. What we find is that it's not the emotion that's a falling, but rather the situation in which the emotion is often but not always found is something akin to a surprise. But the emotion itself is something that we don't fall into at all. As a matter of fact, if you think of any of your own cases, it's probably, if you want to talk about falling at all, it's a pit that you've been digging with your own hard work most of your lives, right? Watching Humphrey Bogart movies and reading comic books and God knows what else. Well, in general then, the thesis here is that romantic love, too, is something that we create for ourselves. We've created it as a society, and there's a sense in which we recreate it new for ourselves every time we actually do it. And of course, because of the thesis I'm trying to advance here, there's nothing about this emotion or any of the others that mean you can only have it when there's a bear that jumps out from you behind a tree, but rather emotions are, and with this I'll end, emotions really are, I want to argue, the most durable, not the most transient, and dependable and important structures of our lives as a whole. Okay.
We'll have time for a few questions. I think I'll ask those in this room to please wait for 5 minutes or so, and we will go across to room number 6 and field the first couple of questions there. If you're lucky, you will hear the sound, if technology works. We're back for questions. Would you please make your question brief? Would you say it loudly enough that Professor Solomon can hear it up here? And I think I'll ask Professor Solomon then to repeat the question before he answers it so that they'll hear it across in the other room as well.
I feel like a doctor on rounds right now. Yes.
Well,
Okay, are there any emotions that are not born of a culture but seem to be universal? The only one that seems to me to be a candidate is fear. But even then, it seems you've got to distinguish between, for example, the bear jumping out from behind the tree. I think anyone in any culture would probably be afraid of that, unless they're Davy Crocker or something. At the same time, there are all sorts of other kinds of fear which certainly don't fall into that category at all. I mean, most of our fears, as a matter of fact, I expect most of the fears that people in this audience have are fears that by no stretch of the imagination could be thought of as instinctual or whatever. The fear of being rejected by someone, the fear of not being successful, or the fear of being successful. Yeah, so I think fear would be the only answer that I could come up with at all, but only in these sort of very primitive cases. Now, I should add very quickly, a lot of theorists with whom I've argued at some length would disagree with that. For example, I've heard jealousy argued to be just such, if not instinctual, to be a kind of epigenetic emotion in Freud's sense, namely that all young children will learn to feel jealousy if they're put in a room with a sibling or a kid their same age and so on. I think that's wrong. I think that's something they're taught, but...
One in the corner here.
Okay. How come in a family with many children, some will be less aggressive, less angry? Well, I mean, the simple answer to that, even assuming that the parents have tried as hard as they can to bring the children up in the same way, is that the sibling relationship itself is going to be a major determinant. Obviously, the oldest child who can get away with it is going to have a much different attitude towards aggression in general and anger than, say, one in the middle who will tend to be the victim. Hesitant to talk in the abstract about your child. But I suppose, I'll put it this way, that there are an awful lot of roles that a two-year-old has already learned. Some of them he may have learned from you without your ever teaching him as such. But of course, I think, and here's one of my big problems with Freud in general, there's so much emphasis on what the parents do for, or even more, to the child, that he almost leaves out entirely what brothers and sisters do, or if there aren't brothers and sisters, even what the family dog might do, or the cat, or people he sees on television. Or, I mean, there are all kinds of influences here, and I wouldn't want to guess which ones they are.
Would you agree with Massey's theory that we learn our values with Dwyer's idea that we choose our emotions, and with the acetylene model that there is a body, emotions, and also a mind?
Well, I would certainly agree that there's a sense in which we choose our emotions. I think that would be the crucial point to agree with. Again, I would want to make the point, which seems crucial, that it's not something you can just sort of choose straight off. I mean, I can't simply say, oh, okay, tonight I'm going to fall in love. I know some people who do that. It never works very well, but yes, there's a sense in which we clearly do choose our emotions. Partly is a society. I mean, there's a sense in which every society sort of goes through the list of, this sounds much too like reading off a menu, but I mean, goes through the list of possible emotions and ticks off the ones at once. And we all do that as individuals too. What complicates that picture, of course, is that none of that is so reflective and voluntary, and none of us ever starts from scratch.
One away at the back, then one here.
Okay. Yes. Yes, I mean, it's an important point, actually. Yes, I do believe that you can have concepts without language. I have philosophical colleagues who disagree with that, but my dog has concepts, there's no question about it. I think the hard question is, what kind of a conception of self animals or pre-verbal creatures, including infants, can have? I think it's much too simple to say they don't have any. I mean, that's the usual philosophical line, and I think it's false. If nothing else, I have a cat and a dog, and they both have a pretty good idea when something's going to happen to one of them rather than the other. That's a concept of self. There's a sense of, if you don't want to call it guilt, there's certainly a sense of expecting punishment and so on. Whether that counts as a full-blown concept of self for people, well, okay, I agree, it probably doesn't. But it's certainly something much more than what, say, some of the Cartesians used to do with animals and look at them as just machines. So I would say, yes, you can have concepts without a language. You can even have a concept of self without a language. It's just a question of how complicated that can get. And I would say, ultimately, not very complicated. Animals can't have a very wide range of emotions. Neither can small children. But, of course, children are smarter than animals, sometimes. Is instinctual love an emotion as it is it cross-cultural? Well, at the risk of offending at least some of the mums in the audience, I will say the following. I don't think love is an instinct, and I don't think infants love. John Watson, the behaviorist, who was playing the favorite game of list the basic emotions, when it came down to it, had a list of three. I don't know why there are always so many threes, but anyway. He listed fear, anger, and he was going to say love, stopped himself, and then said dependency. And that's the word I use too. So I guess what I would say is that there is something like dependency, which is, if it's not instinctual, it's pretty close to it. But not love. Not love. Love is something much more complicated. Love involves respect. Love involves regard. Love involves a sense of the other person's needs and wants. And I don't think infants have that. How about? Sorry. Oh, the mother's relation. Well, of course, the mother's a full-grown adult. I mean, of course, she feels love. But that's something she's taught too. As a matter of fact, I was having a discussion with a woman just the other day who's only recently had a child, and she was in the usual kind of conceptual confusion that follows that event, describing to me how she felt as if she had been, as she put it, conditioned all her life to do this and to want this. And now she wasn't sure. She was now trying to sort out what was really natural, instinctual, and so on, and what was conditioned and learned, and so on. I don't know if you can actually ever do that distinction in practice, but at least, I guess the obvious answer is that, look, mothers are adults. They've had lots of time to learn this, and I'd say in most cases they do. Sure, sure. I mean, and it's easy to think of one mechanism for doing that. If you have a family of several children, particularly if you're one of the younger ones, and if you get angry, you tend to get thrown in a cold shower, but if you tend to be hurt, you're coddled and everybody else is thrown in the shower, then you're going to learn very quickly that a good way of dealing with the world is to be hurt. And as a matter of fact, I would say if you read an awful lot of our contemporary novelists and so on, they've learned it well.
Is your own attitude concerning the sociobiology controversy?
Yes, it's a bit complicated. Ultimately, I think it's not very significant, not very interesting. I mean, there are a few obvious things to say. As Wilson puts it quite nicely in the, I think, very convincing opening paragraphs of his new book, the one on human nature, he says, look, whatever else we are, we're biological creatures, that certainly determines something about us. Well, of course. At the same time, to try and make the claims that he sometimes has made about what it determines about us, I find absolutely futile. And of course, what you have to add to the sociobiological perspective, which is essentially an evolutionary and genetic perspective, is that there is something, as much as I don't like to talk about it, which some French philosophers in particular call the human condition, which is to say that even if something isn't instinctual or genetic or anything of the sort, look, there are certain features which we do as human beings share in common. And to this extent, I will agree there's a human nature. We're all going to die, and we all know that. We all cope with that in various ways. Well, that's certainly not part of sociobiology, but that's a candidate for universality. On the other hand, the most frequent candidate for universality, the incest taboo, turns out just not to work out. I mean, if you talk to almost any anthropologist, what they'll tell you is that to get that thesis out of the sociobiological theory, you have to do an awful lot of redefining of what counts as a family, what counts as a brother or sister, what counts as marriage, and so on. So, yeah, I have some fairly strong attitudes about it, but they're not very interesting, and I think the theory itself ultimately is going to be one of those things that will go down in history books as a debate. You know, it's sort of like the old vitalism mechanism debate in the 19th century. People will say, oh, well, in the 20th century they were worried about nature and nurture.
We have time for, I think, two more of the hands. I've seen one here and one there.
How do you solve the human
drama? I'm sorry? There's two. I'm not sure I understand what. Yeah? Well, I'm not sure. How do I solve? How do you cope with not getting angry? I mean, that's sort of a strange question, given, I guess, all of the books that have been written for us in recent years about how to cope with getting angry. I mean, I think it's a question like, if you ask someone in the 20th century, how do you deal with a slight to your honor? They will probably look at you in a very quizzical way. Now, of course, for Aristotle, that would have been one of the key questions if you're talking about emotions. It's not for us. If you had asked Aristotle, well, tell me, do you feel that you're happy? He would have looked at you very strangely. He would have understood what that meant. So I guess, I don't want to sound like I'm just rejecting the question, but what I'd want to say is that it's a question that we would ask of ourselves, but it's not a question that an Eskimo would ever ask of him or herself, and it's not a question that he or she would respond to in any very interesting way if we were to ask them. I mean, how do you cope when you get angry? And the answer would be, what? I mean, we don't get angry. Only children get angry. That kind of thing. Children and madmen, actually.
How are emotions affected by poor childbirth? And what I mean by that is that once the child is just born, it's taken away from the mother. And there are other examples.
Yeah. How are children affected by problematic childbirth? I don't know. I mean, it's not the kind of field in which I have really any original experience. I mean, you know, I've read the usual experiments with monkeys who are taken away from their mothers and given choices of, you know, mother substitutes and so on. I could make some guesses from that. But again, I think another problem with Freud, but I don't want to take this lightly, is this very heavy emphasis on the absolute determinism of these early experiences. And there's a point where I want to say, oh, come on. I mean, it's not as if my life stopped at one, and now I'm sort of living the footnotes, the way some people have said about Plato and philosophy. So I really can't answer your question just because I don't have the professional expertise there.
Dr. Solomon has indicated he'd be prepared to entertain, I think, a few follow-up questions after we've dismissed. So I'm sorry that we can't accommodate the full forest of hands. I think at this point I'd like to ask Dr. Jim Dybakovsky, the acting head of the philosophy department, to thank Dr. Solomon on our behalf.
I know that Bob Solomon is, from conversations with him, is not only interested in doing philosophy, but in also making it generally accessible. I think that judging from people's reactions this evening, that he's been eminently successful in doing that. And I'm sure that you'll all join me in extending him a final vote of thanks.
Next week, continuing Texas month, Dr. Donald Selden from another part of the University of Texas, chairman of the Department of Internal Medicine, Southwestern Medical School, on high blood pressure, its prevalence, risks, and treatment. If you're a visitor, do pick up a full program as you go by, and if you feel moved to stop at the desk and pay cash, that will be welcome too.